Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Lauren Acampora, author of her debut novel, The Paper Wasp, published in a couple of days by Grove. When last Lauren and I spoke, it was with regard to her wonderful short story collection, The Wonder Garden. It seems like about a year ago, but it's really four. Paper Wasp was named a best summer read. I don't know why summer, maybe because of the wasps, but by both the New York Times and Publishers Weekly. Her short fiction has also appeared in the Paris Review and many, many other periodicals. So, The Paper Wasp is about two women, one beautiful, one plain, one insecure, and one quite confident at different times. It's about a rekindled relationship in which power shifts, spirituality is embraced or given lip service, and plans are made by both women, plans that sometimes work and sometimes don't. My point, somehow made in an extremely disjointed fashion, is that it's hard to know who's successful, who's a failure, who knows what their life is about and who doesn't. And then layered on that is the insecurity of the reader when they're experiencing something that they may at times have no idea whether what they're reading is what is really happening. So with that, welcome back, Lauren, and thanks so much for being here with us again.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me again. It really does feel like the other day we were talking.
I know.
About the Wonder Garden.
I know. So
time goes fast.
Right. So between the Wonder Garden and now, you just sit there and do absolutely nothing, right?
Right. I've been on vacation for 4 years.
That would be great. So it's funny. This is something we talked about briefly before. I mean, I know, and you described very well in a number of places how beautiful Elise was and how drab and stocky Abby was. And she describes herself that way kind of objectively, non-judgmentally in many situations. And yet somehow it was something that both mattered and didn't. Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah. I think that a lot of Abby's self-perception is sort of in her own head. Who knows what she really looks like, to the outside world. She's probably not that bad. But comparing herself consistently to this a literal movie star who's tall and beautiful red hair and green eyes and, you know, extraordinarily striking, it's hard not to feel like the ugly duckling.
Yeah, but she does describe individual traits, like her stockiness, I won't spoil this part of it.
Right.
The one thing. And, you know, the fact that she has to find clothes that she thinks are nice but really aren't nice, all kinds of things. And that goes again, which I wanted to hold off on, but it's a good point to bring it up, is this idea of an unreliable narrator, which is always cool because you're making the reader work throughout the book. And then at the end, and this isn't really giving anything away because it happens in lots of books, at the end the reader has to decide, oh, wow, because, you know, the last page I turned it and I expected another page.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the reader has to decide, well, I wonder, did that really, now what's going to happen? Those kinds of things. And that's what's so cool about the unreliable narrator. But the question is she really an unreliable narrator?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I wrote Abby's character, I didn't really think of her as an unreliable narrator. I just thought of her as an idiosyncratic, very interesting and complex narrator. I mean, whenever we read first-person narration, we are really constricted within one individual's mind. And so, by definition, any first-person narration will be unreliable, if you think of it that way, because all of our points of view are subjective just by matter that it's coming through one person's brain. No one is completely objective in the way they see the world. And it's, you know, by nature, her view is colored through her own experiences, her perceptions, her mental makeup, and you know, her hopes and fears, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I mean, is she unattractive in her mind? She is. Maybe there's some you know, some truth to that from the outside world. But yeah, as I say, I didn't set out to make her unreliable, just complex. And my own favorite novels, you know, with some exceptions, they tend to be novels with first-person narrations that go to dark places. People who you might feel a little conflicted about rooting for. I'm thinking about books like The Secret History by, you know, Donna Tartt. Do you know this book?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, this is a, it's a, this is someone who's complicit in a murder of a classmate. And who just tells the story of how this came to be. Here's my perception of why we behave this way, how this came to happen. Not to make an excuse, but as a confessional. And in a way, that's sort of how I set out to write this book. You could think of it as a confessional. It's written from the first person, but it's addressed to Elise.
Yeah, it's like when I read Julian Barnes' The Sense of an Ending, it was like, for the first three quarters of the book, I was thinking, this guy is kind of like this. And then you're just like walloped with this punch about what the way we think we were and the way we really were. And when that hits you, it's like, wait a minute, did I, because it's just a letter. And then he gets the letter back and he sees, that's not the letter I wrote, but it really was.
Anyway. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. But I love those books. I love the books where you are so deeply within one character's mind that you begin to see the world the way they do.
And the next part of this, which goes with the unreliable narrator, and then when I ask authors this, sometimes they are embraced, it, sometimes they kind of get peeved, which is that there is, in my mind, this element of magical realism. And when you combine that with the unreliable narrator, whether it's dreams, whether it's sketches, whether it's an affinity towards a person who you may never meet but who you really want to meet, then you really get confused, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, what's real and what isn't? What's a dream? What's a fantasy? Yeah, absolutely. I have a friend who read an early copy of the book, and we were having a conversation like this, and it came out that he's like, right, so this, you know, the whole second half of the book was a dream, right? And I'm like, well, I suppose if you read it that way, that you're entitled to that, to seeing it that way. But, you know, I think that's not necessarily how I wrote it. But I could see how it could be read that way, and maybe that's all right. I like ambiguity, and I like surprise. So if someone wants to read the whole novel as wish fulfillment, you know, that's lovely too.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I have the bookstore, and when we have book clubs, which I call fight clubs, it's like, you know, if you put them on one side of the table, the other side of the table, you'll have readers who think completely different about what the book was about.
Yeah.
And I guess that makes you kind of happy, it sounds like.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, I think I do.
I actually, since we last talked, I actually joined a book club myself, which I swore I would never, ever do. But I'm glad that I did. It's an intelligent, funny group of women. We get together, and it's so interesting and educational as a writer to hear the way readers discuss books and how vastly differently they can read them. I mean, the very same pages, it's like we read different books.
How come there's never any guys?
Yeah, why not? I don't know what that is. How come there are no male book clubs? There should be.
Well, we have
men read.
Well, we have.
I know they do. They do it in secret.
We have this nonfiction book club that I'm the moderator of. But basically, all I do after we talk about the book for 5 minutes is I start ranting about Trump, which has eliminated a few of the people. But there are.
Yeah, it happens.
There are some guys who are in the guys seem to like the nonfiction, so they're in the nonfiction book club, but just a few of them. But yeah, I always wonder about that.
Interesting
too.
Discussions could come out of that. I think there should be some more.
Well, the other thing is, I was talking to Damien Barr, who just wrote this book called You Will Be Safe Here. and he has, at the Savoy Hotel in London, a salon. And these authors come, but there's no books sold, there's no books brought, and they just chat beautifully about anything they want to. And then sometimes he has them on the Queen Mary, and sometimes he has them in New York, and it's just like the old-fashioned salon where you just, you have these lovely, interesting people come, and you just see what happens.
You put them all on the boat.
Yeah. And I'd like to do that too, but I don't know that many interesting people.
Invite all the authors.
Yeah, like David Mitchell, geez. And he's had David Mitchell. And
yeah.
Even Jojo Moyes, who I've interviewed like twice now, and I wouldn't think, you know, this is like literature, but he said she's, you know, a wonderful person, and he really enjoys having her there. Anyway, this is what I do. I go off. And we're trying to sell your book. Okay.
I love it. I love it. It's our own little book club.
So, you know, one review said this book was written in the second person. And I'm thinking, well, that guy's nitwit. But then I looked at it, and you can kind of see what he or she was thinking, because the way you have the dialogue that's run by Abby,
right,
you sometimes have a paragraph in which you might get confused until you read the paragraph a second time. Then it becomes as clear as glass.
Right.
You know the kind of paragraphs I'm talking about?
I think so. Who said that it was written in the second person?
I can't remember. And maybe I'm wrong, but I thought it said it was written in the second person.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's an easy mistake to make, because it's written addressing Elise almost in letter form.
Right.
Some people think that that's the second person, but it really is the first person.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, the pure second person would be like, you do this, and then you do that, and there is no I at all.
Right. And the thing is, you might see you might be reading, and then you see a set of quotes, and you go, oh,
right.
Okay, whose are those? And you know they're hers. But anyway, so tell us a little bit about, and maybe it's part of your personal experience, except you're the hot one, is tell us a little about the intense friendship that two girls forge as children, and then surprisingly how it develops into something different when they reunite as adults. Is that something that happened to you, or is it something you just...
No, it is nothing. It's nothing that's happened to me personally. The idea for these two characters came to me really from looking... The first spark came from standing in line at the supermarket, actually. It was, you know, waiting to buy my groceries. I was living in Brooklyn at the time. It was really dark. It was winter. It was just a grimy supermarket. And staring at the magazines and the magazine stands right there by the checkout line, and the tabloids and all the, you know, glitz and glamour and the airbrushing, and looking at these women on the magazine covers in Hollywood, and just, it seemed like another world than from where I was standing. And I thought about, you know, what if one of those women, like those women all had friends when they were kids, and they were probably, they didn't grow up in L.A. Like some of those people grew up in the Midwest. Some people grew up in, Canada, and, you know, it's cold and dark, and it's almost as if they're transported to this never-never land of Los Angeles, where it's all sun, and at least it seems that way from the magazines. And what happened to their old friends? Are they standing in their supermarkets in the Midwest in Canada, looking at their former friend on a magazine cover and thinking, why her and not me? That's sort of, I thought about that mix of feelings that might come from watching a close friend from childhood rocket to this other galaxy. And, you know, the mix of feelings that would come with that, you know, the sort of the pride that you might have in seeing this happen to a peer, the sort of jealousy that might naturally come up, and resentment or confusion, like what was so special about her, the idea that it might seem like it's all a fraud, that this friend that you know so well is being celebrated and as a, you know, superstar.
And
you might be able to see through that and know their foibles in a way that no one else does. So I thought about that relationship just from standing in the supermarket, and thought, what an interesting dynamic that would be to explore.
Yeah.
And that's how Abby and Elise were born. And I thought, of course, you know, Abby should the you know, regular, normal-looking one, and Elise, of course, will have to be this beautiful woman, but, you know, with her own faults and her own weaknesses.
And the other thing is that throughout the book, Abby not only looks at these things, but she collects them.
And, oh, yeah.
And she even collects her sketches that are so mysterious and almost magical. And she kind of collects those, but she keeps them under the bed. And then she collects her dreams, especially the recurring ones, which goes, we could go when we talk about the rhizome and all that. But
yeah.
She seems to like hold this, she does, because her parents are worried about her, they're worried about her sister. She seems to hold all this, and she has absolutely no desire to share it with anybody else.
Yeah.
None.
Yeah, she's very secretive. She's been living in her own head for a very long time.
And then, she likes food a lot, and you, especially like empanadas, and she likes those things that I like little hot dogs wrapped in dough and stuff like that. It's like my favorite hors d'oeuvre, as long as there's Gulden's mustard. Otherwise, I don't even eat them. But she likes food a lot.
They're tasty, yeah.
But since my girlfriend put me on a cleansing diet, that's the end of those.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. It's 30 days, too. And no coffee, no alcohol.
Oh.
I know. It sucks.
A lot of juice.
Yeah, smoothies, soup. I draw the line at kale, but...
I know. Soon you'll be out in L.A.
Right, exactly.
With your juice cleanse.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So anyway, she likes food a lot, but then also she likes to drink a lot, going back to the high school reunion, and so does Elise, going back to the high school reunion. In many ways, that may be what brought them together that night. And also in many ways, it kind of moves the book along. There's several scenes in which alcohol plays a big part in where people are going and how they're thinking. And
that's very true. And I think that's true in real life.
Yeah, I guess
you know,
it is.
People lose their inhibitions, and you know, some true things come out, and you know, that moves the story along. Yeah, Elise, when she just casually invites Abby, she's wasted at that reunion, and she's that's how people get. Oh my gosh, we were best friends. I've missed you so much. Oh, you have to come and stay with me in L.A. You know, and then the next morning they forget they said it or didn't really mean it. But at the moment, it was nothing could be more true at the moment.
Yes.
So maybe, deep down, she really did miss Abby.
Well, that goes to the next question, which is a serious part of the book, is, Abby, does what she does with regard to money and all that. And then she just hops on and there she is. And and I was thinking Elise is going to go. And you set it up that way. You set it up like, oh, I had no idea you were actually going to. And then all of a sudden, things change again.
Yeah.
Where did that? That was a pivotal point. Well, obviously, that was the pivotal point in the book. And did you know what Elise was going to say? Because if she said the other thing, you wouldn't have a book.
you mean did I know that she would ultimately invite to stay?
Yeah,
you know, here she is confronted with this old friend who just shows up on her doorstep with nowhere else to stay. I mean, she's put in a bind, and what's she going to say? She's going to say, go away?
Well, she's a movie star. She can say whatever she wants.
That's true. But I think deep down, and this is what came out when she was so drunk at the reunion, she has been quite lonely in Hollywood. I mean, she has friendships, but they're superficial. And they're new friendships, and they're with other actresses who are just as ambitious as she is. So here comes Abby, who she sees as, as completely unthreatening. She's not in the business. She's not ambitious, at least Elise doesn't think she is. She's not attractive. She is devoted to Elise and knows her from, childhood days, and is completely loyal and adoring. This is how Elise sees her, and she thinks, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to have someone like that in my life right now, to be a grounding force and a support, and somebody to flatter me and give me encouragement. and just somebody I don't have to worry how I behave around or how I look around. I can just be myself. And I think that, you know, from what I have heard, you know, her tell, that, you know, there is a need for that. You know, people who are in this cutthroat business really value from deep friendships like that.
Yeah.
And people who've known them from before they were famous, I think those friendships are very important.
Yeah, I think with famous people.
And I've heard that it's true that some actresses do end up hiring friends as their personal assistants.
Yeah, it's
the
like
only people they feel they can completely trust.
It's like the TV show The Entourage, that kind of thing.
Right.
You get your best friends.
Yeah, exactly.
But the other thing here, and this is, I don't know whether it's something that's left to the reader, is the power dynamic between Elise and Abby when they were little.
Right.
It's completely different. And
mm-hmm.
and that changes again when they get together. And also with Abby's feelings towards Elise changing throughout their relationship. But what Abby remembers most are the stories that... what Elise remembers most are the stories that Abby used to tell. And the stories are all dark. And you just hint at that. Because you'll just say that the woman who lived down the lane and da 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 da, reader kind of knows that these were not necessarily pleasant stories, but Elise kind of glommed onto them and really, she remembered all of them. She remembered all of them.
Yeah. Abby is a talented, gifted storyteller, and I think of her as a visionary, and a truly gifted person, and. She had the power in the relationship when they were children, when she and Elise were children. She was the storyteller. She was the creator, and Elise acted out Abby's stories. So in a sense, you could think of Abby as the director of their friendship from early on. And then, of course, Elise, flits away and goes to L.A., becomes famous. And in that sense, she then holds the power when they reunite, and of course, slowly but surely, the tables turn and the power begins to shift again. And Abby, in her own mind, has never really let go of that power. But it's not really even about it. The book, it is about the friendship and the power dynamic of this female friendship, of course. But beyond that, I really think of it more as almost an allegory about art. I think of it as about artistic ambition and what it takes to create and disseminate art. I also think of it in a way as a fairy tale and a fantasy in a sense. And it could be read as a fantasy and, as I said before, a wish fulfillment for an artist. That here is, Elise is living out her fairy tale as a Hollywood actress, sort of the conventional fairy tale, but Abby's story, the story of the paper wasp, could be seen as Abby's fairy tale, living out, getting to her never, never land, where she is, and without giving too much away, where she then has the power of creation and dissemination.
Yeah, and it's not... definitely not telegraphed, but when Abby and Elise are small, younger, there's the idea of this director that Abby loves and Elise is drawn into. There's the idea of the sketches. There's the idea of, as you said, being a director. There's those kind of things that carry on all the way to this thing called the rhizome. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that was Elise draws Abby to it, but Elise only has kind of like this superficial relationship with that place.
Yeah.
Whereas Abby begins to really grow into it, especially with regard to the gentleman who helps her along and goes close to the idea of lucid dreaming. Mm-hmm. And the one area which I didn't want to talk about because it's a spoiler is that this one event that was traumatic in her life happens over and over again, and not only in her dreams and in her thought process, and it constantly evolves. And what question should I ask?
Yeah. I think that, I'm sure that Jung would have something to say about that blockage that she has to get out of this rut, this blockage that's holding her back, and this recurring dream of this self-destructive recurring dream that keeps haunting her.
I know, and
it's an episode in her past, and she needs to work through it, and the lucid dreaming helps her.
And it's so cool the way you set it up, because it's a literal blockage, you know, and it's a figurative blockage, which I guess you gave some thought to.
Right. Yeah, and you know, Elise is using the rhizome herself as, you know, just career promotion. Using it as networking and to try to, you know, get better roles. She's really just going through the motions, whereas, you know, Abby really gets it. She understands the power of dreams and that psychological advancement that she can gain from going into her own dreams and really starting to live in them. I mean, she brings it to a whole other level.
Yes, and it's a really scary one, whereas Elise is interested in manicures and massages.
Yeah.
And the idea, two things. One, obviously, the rhizome, which is this idea of a plant that has these roots that are underground that continue to grow side by side. You know, there's like the largest living organism in the world, apparently, is some fungus that is essentially a rhizome. Or if you live in Florida, there's this horrible grass called St. Augustine grass, which is essentially a rhizome. So, obviously, the person whose name we will not mention, who set up the rhizome, there's obviously this connection between these interconnections, and that also leads the reader into a conundrum. You know, what exactly does this mean, and who exactly is connected, and how far are they connected, and how far away are they connected? So you just used one word and created this whole world.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I hadn't really thought about the rhizome in the way you just described it, but it really works well metaphorically. The idea of the rhizomatic root with all the, you know, offshoots connecting, you know, grasses or trees, or you could say human beings over the course of, you know, hundreds of miles, just like Elise and Abby, or Abby thought that they were connected, that she and Elise were connected through this kind of metaphysical dreamscape. That she was sharing dreams with Elise at night. And, you know, things get a little bit, you know, get a little metaphysical there. But I had originally conceived of the rhizome as an analogy for creativity and the idea of the sort of collective unconscious, where we get creative ideas from this spring or a wellspring of inspiration and creative ideas. But absolutely, I mean, the idea that that people can be connected through the rhizome this way too. It's fascinating. I think about that a lot. And strangely enough, the title came from the research that I did into rhizomes.
Oh,
weirdly.
That's interesting.
I had been reading. There are these French philosophers, Deleuze and Guattari, who had written about the rhizome in this really deeply theoretical way. About the notion of creativity and rhizomatic linkages in nature. And without getting too abstract, I'll just say that they are really obsessed with this one particular wasp that came out in their writings, and it led me to research wasps and learn more than I ever wanted to know about wasps. But they are really fascinating, and wasp culture is sort of strangely rhizomatic and connected in very mysterious ways that they all know how to behave. I mean, it's like watching, you know, when you watch ants or wasps and the way they communicate and just cooperate, it's fascinating to see how they do this without language that we can interpret anyway. But the fact that paper wasps, in particular, they actually build their own nest out of their own saliva. They chew wood pulp and make this kind of fibrous matter, and that's how they construct their nests. And I thought of that. I'm like, what could be closer to the art-making process than that? You know, creating a habitat out of your own saliva.
I'm totally on board because...
And I thought of that as such a great metaphor for what Abby is doing. That she is just making her own world out of her own saliva.
Yeah. Well,
did I just completely lose you?
No, I keep thinking about the paper wasp nest that's connected. My house was built in 1775, and there's this paper wasp nest every year, and it's gigantic, but I can't do anything with it because it is a total work of art.
Aren't they beautiful?
It's absolutely beautiful in so many different ways. But Deleuze, I tried reading him one time, and I got so frustrated trying to understand one word of it that I threw the book across the room. And
I understand.
It was so hard. Listen to this quote I found about paper wasp. When the wasp spirit animal comes flying into your life, you are being reminded that wishing and dreaming about your desires will not make them come true. In some cultures, the wasp meaning is a symbol of control over your life circumstances. It also signifies evolution, progress, development, and order. Isn't that cool?
Wow, where did you see that?
I don't know. Probably started with Wikipedia and worked my way down.
Huh, it almost sounds like dream interpretation.
I know.
If a wasp is in your dream, here's what it means.
I know, so that
but
kind
it
of...
It sounds like if a wasp enters your 1775 house. This is what it means for you. It's auspicious, right?
Yeah, it is. And also, that wasp, you know, the house has been there, and six generations of people have sat in front of the fireplace, and they've all done exactly the same thing. Sit in front of the fireplace, look at the fire, and think.
Yeah.
And that's what the wasps have been doing the whole time, too. And so I never think like I own the house. It's like, I'm here waiting. I'm here taking care of it for the next people that sit in front of the fireplace.
You're the steward.
I'm the steward. That's exactly the word I use.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what really is funny but completely off track is that every time I find an author that I really, really like, it's always the Bill Clegg Agency.
And oh, really? You know what's funny? I feel the same way. I love his authors. It's really great.
And then I interviewed him, and he was great too, and he's had such an interesting life, and then I don't know how he's done what he's been able to do. It's amazing, absolutely amazing.
I know. I think he has a few clones.
He must. He's so.
He has to. I have the same question. How does he do all this? I don't know.
I don't know either. And, you know.
Some people just have more hours in the day than others.
That's definitely true.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'm a huge fan of his other authors, and that makes me happy.
I like it because his website is really simple. It says past, forthcoming, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says if you want to write something in, write it here. We won't be able to write you back, but you write what your project is about, but here it is. And that's it.
Oh, that's the submission,
the
inquiry? All right.
yeah,
no, I feel very lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good combination. It really is. And he's a good mentor, leader, whatever you might consider him. I think he's really ingenious. But again, well, that's helping your book right there. That's okay. So as we get towards the end, you know, do you think that well, two things. I always think of the movie Sliding Doors. I mean, just the idea that for whatever reason, Abby was avoiding Elise at the high school reunion, and Elise just found her. And you get to the point where that moment is what changed everything. And you created that moment because easily, again, you wouldn't have a book, but she was drunk enough that she could have just been pushed out the door with her friends and just talked out the door, and Abby would have just been sitting there getting drunker herself, and nothing would have happened. And those are the kind of things that decide your life for you.
Yeah. And that's when those are the moments of truth where, you know, your true nature really comes out. Are you going to go for it or not? And Abby is someone who acts. I mean, she does ultimately find her agency, and she realizes this is a make it or break it moment. She just knows that she has to make this dream of hers literally and figuratively come true by making Elise see her. So she does go, like, she moves at that moment and makes it happen.
Yeah, when she does.
And, I had struggled, you know, back with the Wonder Garden, my previous book,
right.
I had written a whole novel about one of those characters before ultimately disbanding the novel and turning it into the stories that became The Wonder Garden, but the frustration I had with that novel was that my main character didn't have agency. She was such a passive character, and that's why the novel didn't work. And this is the first time that I've stayed with a character for the course of a book and really given her agency, for lack of a better word, that this is somebody who makes things happen. She goes from being a real just sort of a loser sitting in her parents' house in this small town and just feeling grim and sorry for herself, but just building and building up the nerve to start making moves, and she does.
Yeah,
and that felt really good. Felt really good to write someone like that.
And there's three things, like, you know, the first thing I thought of that was pivotal is when she's at the house and Elise is out and she's looking at the laundry and she says, let her do her own laundry. And that, I knew something was going to happen. And then I couldn't figure out, why is she visiting her sister? And then I thought afterwards, did she know then? And then when she leans down and takes what she takes, I'm thinking, she's got it all figured out. And she did it in this incredibly much better than I've ever done anything, and left no traces. And okay, yeah, I can't do that. I'm spoiling it.
At a certain point, she almost feels as if she's plugging into a script. It's almost as if she's plugged into dream logic, that she's almost following through instinctually rather than planning logically. And she's trusting her subconscious implicitly.
Yeah,
and it's like going through. Right.
And her sketches, if they really do portray what actually she sees, especially at the very ending, this is exactly what she drew and has been drawn to for whatever reason for so long. And then even the dream that she has with regard to Elise's polo playing, guy. And he comes down in the morning and he looks at her and she looks at him, and theoretically, they both know exactly what they're thinking. And that's where the idea comes in. Well, is she really, is this crazy, or is she really able to have this ability? And
I don't know. And I can't really answer that question, because
good.
I like to keep that open. There are times, I don't know about you or the rest of the people out there, but I've had dreams myself that I have been almost convinced have had some sort of mysterious knowledge in them. Either they have felt more real than real life, and I personally do believe that there's something else going on when we're asleep, and that we're in touch with truths that we cannot be aware of in our conscious life. I really think that there's something to that, and it was really fun to explore the possibilities in this book. And that's the fantasy, as you say, the magical realism element. It was me playing with the possibilities of dream knowledge.
Yeah, I have a couple of those seminal dreams that stick with me and always will for the rest of my life. And I wonder, sometimes somewhat, I guess, tragically, why didn't I do that?
Act on something that you knew from a dream?
Yeah, I'll tell you real quick. Mm-hmm. I had this dream after my father died, and it was this kingdom, and he was king, and I was prince, and he was on this white horse, and he handed me this key, and I knew it was a very important key, and I knew, just like Abby knows, I knew what it unlocked, and it unlocked this box that had inside of it, kind of like the box in Pulp Fiction, and I ran and ran and ran, but there was a flood. And everything was getting deeper and deeper. And I got to the box, but it was underwater, and I couldn't get to it, and I couldn't put the key into it. And that was it.
What could you have done with that in real life? Did you know what you could do?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a heck of a dream.
Listen to this one. You know how you dream of a room in a house and it's never been there before, and Freudian and Jungian?
Oh, I love that.
The extra room is your subconscious. So I go into this house that I owned, and there's this extra room. And I go inside, and there's this beautiful library with all these vellum and red Morocco and green and blue Morocco bookshelves, all on all the shelves. And then there's this guy there named Gandalf, not named Gandalf, he looks exactly like Gandalf, with a staff and a long cloak and a long white beard, and he looks at me and he takes the staff and gestures around the entire room and he goes, "All this could have been yours."
Yeah.
And that was it.
Oh, boy.
I know.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Well, I do know. I do know in both of them. I knew what it was in both of those dreams, exactly what it was I hadn't done that I could have or should have or might have done. Which is,
yeah, that's exactly it. So you know what I mean. Those are the kinds of dreams I mean.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think that we all know that. And to dismiss them, you know, as you say, it's dangerous to dismiss those dreams.
Which goes exactly to what here it is written down, my last question.
Yeah.
In conclusion, do we follow those dreams, no matter how weird or off-putting they might be?
Do we follow them?
Yeah. Where they would lead us, which she does.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with how you interpret the meanings of dreams. I mean, sometimes if you take them completely literally or as a sign to you know, behave a certain way in real life, I don't know. I mean, like, for instance, with the dream of the box, I mean, I don't know if there was a literal box that you had a key for or if that meant something else. But I do love interpreting dreams.
Yeah,
I do it all the time with my husband and my friends, if they'll ever tell me their dreams. I love that.
Hey, so thanks so much again for being here for the second time, and I'd love to have you back. And if you ever come to Philadelphia, please stop by the bookstore.
You know I will.
I know you will. That's great. That's a great feeling for me. So, again, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, really a lot of fun.
Yes, it has been. So, we were talking with Lauren Acampora, who is one of my favorite, very favorite authors. And based on the Paris Review story, The Wonder Garden, which is a collection of stories that kind of are linked together, which is great. And then this new one, which is just The Paper Wasp, which is just great. It's like, you know, you get these books once in a while, and I mean, it happens a lot on the show, but sometimes it really happens. And you get a book that's like, yeah, this is so amazing. And, you know, the ones I like are the ones where you don't know what's going on to a certain extent. You don't know what the character is going to do next. And at the very end, you don't know what's going to happen or if what's going to happen is what you expect it to happen. And then during the book, something happens that, oh, I had no idea she was going to do this. And then you see how it was carefully planned out. But anyway, enough of that. But I really enjoy talking to Lauren, and yeah, it's just a pleasure. So keep coming back. One of the people that I mentioned in this interview is Damien Barr. Hopefully his interview will be after this one, who will discuss his latest book, which is called You Will Be Safe Here, which is also riveting. And then Catherine Ebon will join us to discuss a nonfiction book, which is an expose. It's called Bottle of Lies, which is the inside story of the generic drug boom. And it's fascinating, and it's also scary, and sometimes a little eek. Like, I can't believe that I took that, knowing that there were little shards of metal in it. Anyway, so for a complete schedule of who's coming up, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com. You can simply download our podcast at Podomatic, which is really easy, or you can just go to iTunes, where my 450 or whatever are listed, and just download those or just listen to them or subscribe to the channel, and you get all the new ones. Okay, so thanks a lot. Hope you'll be back here next week on The Avid Reader.